The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Peter Berard is a doctoral candidate in history at Boston College. He's also a writer for publications such as Jacobin and the LA Review of Books. Berard and I discuss the Black Bloc and Antifa tactics in an effort to take a more sympathetic look at these anarchist tacticians. And although the conversation here is not entirely uncritical, it's a more sympathetic one than the one you heard on the Punching Nazis or Shall We Punch Nazis podcast. Topics covered in this podcast include how we should go beyond the rigid definition of fascism that comes from Trotsky, and that was repeated by Brendan O'Neill on that Punching Nazis podcast, the Kurt Vonnegut novel Mother Night, a now mostly defunct assessment of Milo Yiannopoulos' career, and many other pertinent questions. This is the 100th episode of the Zero Books podcast. My name's Doug Lane, and I am the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. My thanks goes out to Kevin Dole, who sent me a congratulatory email. Kevin Dole is the inventor of Bizarro Fiction. He is the author of Tangerine Effant, and at this point, he's a longtime friend. Thanks goes out to members of the Zero Books Club as well. Zero Books Club members receive access to the Inside Zero Books podcast, which sometimes consists of unedited or full-length interviews from the Zero Squared podcast, sometimes features conversations with Zero Books readers, that is, people who assess the manuscripts with me, about the state of the left, and sometimes features public lectures from Zero Books authors or staff. The music you're listening to is a vaporwave version of Depeche Mode's Enjoy the Silence. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Peter Berard and I discuss the ins and outs of Antifa. Peter Berard is getting his PhD in history from Boston College and has an MA from the New School of Social Research. He is a freelance writer for publications such as Jacobin and the LA Review of Books. Did I get that?
Yeah,
right?
That's about right.
Yep,
that's all accurate, and my biography is appropriately short.
Well, do you have anything you want to add to those?
No, that pretty much does boil. That does boil most of it down. You know, I spend a lot of time in grad school, and I occasionally write stuff for people.
Let's just start talking about the Black Bloc. I contacted you because you were recommended to me as someone who knew something about the Black Bloc and Antifa and I guess anarchism as well. I wanted to reach out to someone who had a different perspective on it than I did, or was more sympathetic to the tactics that are being used right now than I am. But I'm more sympathetic than maybe people think as well. So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, I can't really claim to be an expert on it. I know a little bit about it. I guess I would say I'm somewhat more sympathetic than at least the previous. I listened to the podcast last night. Mm-hmm. What I'm an expert on, and actually I found the recommendation, my friend Garrett, I believe. You know Garrett?
I think so.
Yeah, Garrett Cook. He's another writer, also.
Yeah, he's a bizarro writer.
Yeah. He's good. I went to Marlboro College with Garrett, and we were friends there. We spent some time together. He used to live where I live now in Watertown, Mass, and we used to hang out. He's a good guy.
Yeah.
I think he recommended me on the basis of that I study history, I do politics stuff, and that I study counterinsurgency. That's what my dissertation field is on. The history and development of it, which, you know, I was racking my mind to try and figure out ways how to apply it to this case. And I'm sure perhaps somebody cleverer than I am could, but most of the counterinsurgency stuff I do wouldn't really apply here. I think most counterinsurgents would see both sides, your Antifas and your Fuzz, for lack of a better term, as the kind of people who need to be sort of managed or else taken out of the picture. So I guess instead I'll, give my somewhat, most of my writings, for instance, if you looked up any of my articles, they're not, most of them aren't on counterinsurgency. They're book reviews or whatever else. Mm-hmm. So I'm perfectly willing to give my dilettantish opinion. For the most part, I think black bloc tactics are not great. I think that fighting fascists makes a certain degree of sense. I think that random property destruction generally doesn't. I've known Antifa people in my time. They're a mixed bag in my experience. The ones who are willing to talk to me about it emphasize the defensive nature of what they do, that it's not all punching people, though it's a certain amount of it is, and that's clearly something that they, see as the very least symbolically important part of what they do. The ones I know don't do the property destruction bit, or at least they don't say they do. So I really don't know how that enters into it beyond just that's what black bloc people do, especially in the East Bay, is my understanding, is that that's just kind of what happens.
Here's the thing. I have similar experiences. I've known people who were involved. I'm not sure if I would say they're involved in Antifa or black bloc politics. What I've known, the people I've known have been anarchists of different stripes, and some of them, like I knew someone who ended up in prison for a while for an action that he took part in. He ended up in prison for a few years. But those tactics were, I don't know if I would consider those to be really the same as the Antifa tactics, or the movement wasn't, maybe they're same tactics, but they weren't aimed at in the same direction. This was sort of an anti-civilization, green anarchist movement that I knew about tangentially. But what would you say the aim of the Black Bloc is? Is it sort of a resistance movement, sort of like trying to hold back an insurgency from the far right, from the fascists, or is it something more than that?
I think they would, from my knowledge, blanch pretty strongly at being described as counterinsurgents, because they would see themselves as the insurgents, and they would see the fascists as being on the side of, capital, civilization, whatever else they don't like, or the state. My understanding from the anti-fascists I know is that part of it's just, basically just boils down to general principle, which is Nazis are bad. When they're around in public, we should fight them, which I don't know if that's a good principle or not. I tend to at least emotionally agree with it. The other, and somewhat more thought out principle, is that if you, and I'm sure you've heard this and many listeners have heard this, that if you don't nip this kind of thing in the bud, then it expands, that you not just expand, but also like kind of in the immediate aftermath of public displays. It emboldens people. For instance, immediately after the Trump election, it's been somewhat exaggerated, but there was this upsurge of, hate crimes. A lot of people, assaulting people or whatever else, yelling the name Trump as though it's some sort of magical totem, as though the election itself. Yeah, it really makes you wonder, because it's not like before the election people were so vigilant about these things. But I think the idea is the election itself sort of felt as though it gave these people permission. And I think it's the same when you get these sort of public, when fascists are allowed to kind of publicly rally, publicly show up without a firm, counter is, I think, the theory.
You know, this is one of the things that bothered me most about this last election, that even if Hillary Clinton had won, was so troubling about the process of the campaign, was that both because of Trump's, I wouldn't even call them dog whistles, but I would say almost outright appeals to the KKK mm-hmm. and other far-right groups, and because of the Democrats' response to it and the centering of that aspect of the Trump campaign as a central component of the campaign, both of those things tended to elevate what were fringe movements in the past. And so I was concerned about, especially towards the end of the campaign, about just how far to the right the mainstream was becoming, or that's not exactly right, but just how emboldened the alt-right was. Mm.
The attention economy is interesting here, because I do think that Clinton name-checking them was probably helpful to them, because although at least in part, I think it's not just the attention always equals them gaining support in a positive sense. I do think that if you attack them and it's ineffective or sort of feckless, as it was in the case of Clinton, then you wind up they get a bunch more attention. They however many Google searches resulted from that, it was all helpful to them.
Well, I'm gonna tell you, fascists, you may be surprised. People in this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose. You fascists bound to lose.
Woo! All you fascists bound to lose.
I said,
all you fascists bound to lose.
Yes,
all you fascists bound to lose. You're bound to lose. You fascists bound to lose.
There's people of every nation marching side by side, marching across the fields where a million fascists died. You're bound to lose. You fascists bound to lose.
I have a friend who was very convinced that the best way to defeat Trump was to humiliate him somehow during the process of the campaign. And let's just stick with that for a moment, because it didn't work, this approach. I mean, I think it was generally that was the approach taken, and the risk was that if you failed to humiliate him, you would embolden him or empower him, and that's certainly what happened. And I also thought that the risk of trying to humiliate someone like Trump is that you, the blows that you do, that do connect, might actually deepen the sense of connection between Trump and people who are kind of humiliated on a daily basis just by the being a, part of the lower classes or working classes.
Sure.
It's a difficult walk. I mean, what I think would work best, and this is my gut, I have no real facts to back me, is if Trump were seen to be kind of self-humiliating rather than a victim of someone else. But which he is, right? I mean, he is completely self-humiliating on a daily basis.
Yeah. I think it's that, and I also think in that instance, I really do think it's because the Democratic Party, and Hillary Clinton failed to, they thought that humiliation alone would do it and not offering any kind of alternative.
Right.
Right? They didn't offer any kind of alternative vision. They just said, okay, all you people, it's going to be the same, basically, except I'm going to be in charge and I'm a competent manager. And this guy's a lunatic. This guy's silly. You know, he's undignified.
Right.
And for people who are suffering from, neoliberalism and what comes in its wake, that's not enough.
Right. And also, when you feel like you have no dignity, you might want to go with the guy who's undignified.
Right. Right. Yeah. I think, I think it was Alex Zaitchik, who's a writer. He wrote the book Gilded Rage, which I haven't read, but I heard an interview with him, said it's like the Trump was the vote was a vote that was like keying a car, like a BMW that your boss owns.
Right.
And you want to, and the worse he is, the worse the keying you're giving that car.
Yeah, Michael Moore said something similar to that. He said that going into the voting booth for these people will be a way to send the biggest fuck you in history to the elites that run this country. Let's go back to the Antifa movement. Do you think of it as a part of a political battle? I know they think of themselves as an insurgent movement. Do you think of the Antifa movement as part of a political battle against the establishment, or is it a culture war within the current society?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think in theory, it could be made into a political movement. I think often it's not, that due to the organizational slant, due to its sole focus most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time on, this small, but, this real, but, ultimately not that powerful threat of fascists, that they often don't reach out. There's this sort of, I think it's overstated, but certainly, and I think it usually is worse in places, ironically, where there's less fighting to do. So in Boston, I have noticed a certain, I don't know if macho is the right word, but a certain amount of swagger and a certain refusal to deal with other leftist groups who are trying to make a political campaign because I think they see us as soft. My experience, how I felt about this whole debate in the last few weeks is it's like I felt that I had a certain amount of difficulty being heard by either side. So the Antifa don't like to listen to people who tell them to moderate their tactics or to do things differently or who aren't part of their group. Right? There's this, you might have experienced this with anarchist politics, that there's a certain cliquishness involved.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been true in my experience with Antifa. Now, if you it's modified by the fact that if you sign up and if you agree with their premises, they'll take you in regardless of who you are. But if you don't, you can't really offer, you can't say, hey, I agree with you, but maybe do things somewhat differently. In my experience, maybe your mileage may vary. On the other side, the anti-Antifa, they don't really want to hear about it either because they have their own line of often kind of vaguely psychological analysis of what's going on. It's been a weird debate.
Yeah. Well, when you felt that you weren't being heard by people who were very critical of the anti-fascists and the Black Bloc, what weren't they hearing? What were you trying to tell people that they weren't able to grok?
I think it was less an inability to grok it and more they were kind of enjoying their, I think, probably they've had experiences where, or they see online, mm-hmm. How often all of this stuff, and they don't like it, and they want to have their, say. The part, what I would emphasize is, the two major lines that I get of anti-Antifa are that it's a distraction from organizing, which is asserted without evidence.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people I know who are enthusiastic for Antifa also organize some, or at least sympathizers with it. I don't know, the Antifa people I know themselves, it's pretty small a number, but at least some of them do also organize with other more positive, if you want, positive in the sense of, building something sense. And the other is that, we should have, this line that it's an indication of intellectual cowardice. We should be debating the Milo Yiannopouloses and the Richard Spencers of the world as though this is like a Lincoln Douglas type situation. And it isn't. I think that there could be use for debate if we could, we wouldn't want to put our best theoretician up there to debate these guys. We'd want to put somebody funny up there who could humiliate them.
Okay.
Because I do think, I don't think that they have ideas in the sense that we do. I think they have a variety of hatreds and prejudices that they mold ideas around. It is about the violent affirmation of hierarchy for them. And if it could be proven that they can't do that, then I think that's the way to go forward.
Well, see, I think Milo is a unique case because I don't actually think he's fundamentally, in a deep sense, a fascist. I think he's a right winger who uses his homosexuality as a shield to allow him to say racist and homophobic even and sexist things. But that he's not, I don't think he's to the right, very far to the right of just, say, Trump.
I do think, sorry, go ahead.
But we can debate that. But the point that I would make with him is that he, if he is a kind of fascist, he's the kind of fascist that Slavoj Žižek talked about and talks about. He was on my podcast and he described this. It's like they're fascists in the name of liberal diversity. Like he will say, I am against Islam, I'm against Muslims because I am pro homosexual, because I care about women's rights, because I want to stop this illiberal infusion of Islam into the Western world. And that is an idea. That's not just a prejudice, and it's borne out by some facts, right? I mean, if you want to find the nations where homosexuals are treated the absolute worst, going to Saudi Arabia or other Muslim nations is a pretty good place to start. So he's not entirely wrong there. So it would take someone going beyond just, hey, you're a racist, or hey, that's not a nice thing to say.
They have their points, but the point's not the point, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I think that to a large degree, the performance is the point. So you'd want somebody who is also a performer. And speaking as somebody who detests these ideas, whether you want to call Yiannopoulos a fascist or not, I would say he fits my definition. It's not impossible to be a gay fascist.
Right.
There certainly were some. I think that his concern for homosexuals and for women is fake. I don't believe in it. I think that it really is more or less about, because I know a lot of people who are concerned with those who aren't violent Islamophobes or transphobes, for that matter. Because I hold to the idea that either it's going to be freedom for everybody or it's going to be freedom for nobody, and that's a very basic point for me.
I agree.
So, and I know you agree with that. I just figured I'd,
right. It's good to put that out there.
Yeah, there's very serious problems with homophobia and, in Islamic societies. And that's something that I think that people within those societies need to deal with. But I don't think that's, well, anyway. Yeah. Point is,
here's my point of view on this. I think the idea that refugees from Syria or any Islamic immigrants coming to the West are going to, in a significant way, transform our culture to make it more homophobic is an absurd notion. The difficulties might be between small enclaves of immigrants of different kinds and the establishment mm-hmm. in this country. And that becomes really sometimes problematic, or it's not always easy to negotiate. So, for instance, you have people in this country and they come from a culture where arranged marriages are the norm and they're continuing mm-hmm. that tradition. And that flies in the face of legality even here, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
sure.
So you have
a problem. Yeah, it's always an adjustment.
Yeah. It's not a simple one. It's just a deep adjustment, too, because you really are asking them to abandon aspects of their culture to adjust to living here. But certainly that's the direction it's going, right? It's this culture, this legal establishment, asking people who are new to this culture to abandon aspects of their culture to fit, not the other way around. That just isn't happening, and it won't happen, you know? So it's dumb to talk about it. But anyway.
Yeah, I got to say, if anything, I almost respect the other part of what I was going to say before I got distracted by some spiel or another, is that I don't respect either one of them, but if I had to, I would almost respect Richard Spencer, more than I would Yiannopoulos, because he doesn't provide as many outs to his ideology, right? He's forthright about it. He doesn't wrap it up in quite as many layers of protective irony. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is just the fact that, you know, it's as he might put it, approaching like, wherein that we're not alike in much, but we are both grad students. He's got failed grad student written all over him. I haven't failed at it quite yet. And so, yeah, with Yiannopoulos, I almost think that it's more, objectively speaking, what he does is more or less recruit for the far right. He does it in this quasi-deniable kind of way. Mm-hmm. I don't have any problem. The other fellow you had on, the guy from
Spiked,
who uses the it's so funny, you know, all the Trotskyites I know would sooner drink poison than read Spiked, but they converge on using, you know, in an almost charming way, on using the ignition sequence model of fascism, which comes from Trotsky, which is that you need to have the big scary labor movement before you have fascism. Which, you know, this doesn't mean it's wrong. Maybe it is right, but I could tell you that that framework isn't taken particularly seriously in the historical study of fascism these days. So I have no discomfort calling these people fascists.
Yeah. Well, I don't have any discomfort calling someone like Spencer a fascist, and I don't even have trouble calling someone like Milo a proto-fascist or someone like Trump a proto-fascist. But I think it's important to – like I think Milo is being moved as much as he's moving, you know, what he found was a target, which was extreme political correctness in online feminist culture. And he found that target and created his own persona as its opposite. And that moves him in a certain direction. And it moves him towards a hyper-masculinist, far-right authoritarian position, which I would call, at the very least, proto-fascist. And I agree with you that I don't think that you need a far-left labor movement threatening the state for fascism to arise. That's just one way that it has historically.
You ever read Kurt Vonnegut's Mother Night?
Yes. Yeah,
wouldn't it be funny if he was a Mother Night type? You know, I don't remember the character's name, but you know, for those of you who haven't read it, you know, Mother Night is a Kurt Vonnegut novel. It's about he was meant to be a pretty left leaning playwright, right? The main character.
Yeah,
yeah. This left leaning playwright is sent by the OSS or somebody to imitate a Nazi player. He infiltrates Nazi Germany. And it forms this sort of farcical American division. It's not really a division. It's like eight people of the SS and blah, blah, blah. You know, he's in with all of them. But then, you know, he's stuck with it in the end.
This has been Howard W. Kimball, Jr. Heil Hitler.
Your government will never acknowledge your role as an agent. You come looking for a pardon, they'll deny they ever heard of you.
Well, how many people did know what I was really doing?
There were three of us. The third, I'm sorry to say, is dead.
Why doesn't the government come forward and say this man you're spitting on is a hero?
Your role will remain classified, and Uncle Sam's official position is that you're the scum of the earth.
What are you thinking? I'm a Nazi? I wasn't a Nazi.
Take a good look at your crowd, friends. because you're next.
Even if you were a spy, you could never have served the enemy as well as you served us. All the ideals that make me proud of being a Nazi, they came not from Hitler, but from you.
God damn you! You're a dead liar!
Tell me what you live for, and I will live for that too!
The moral here is, you must be careful what you pretend to be. Because in the end, you are what you pretend to be.
Well, let's talk, let's go back to anarchism and the anti-fascist movement a bit here. Let me just tell you an anecdote, a little story that from my past. When I was back in the mid-90s, when I was in my 20s, I worked in a phone room for the American Heart Association, and I would go into work kind of all scruffily dressed and with Birkenstocks on and, you know, the typical Northwest Portlander kind of attire for someone in their 20s in the 90s. And there was a guy there who worked with me. It was a black man, about maybe 10 years older than I was, always really well-dressed, tie, suit. And I kind of thought of him as a conservative. But we were talking on our break, and I somehow ended up telling him that I considered myself to be an anarchist. And he sort of stepped back from me at that point, and he asked me if I liked Hitler. Now, this was in the Pacific Northwest. And there, at the time, there was some kind of unfortunate crossover between green anarchism and fascist movements, I think. But what do you think fascists and anarchists have in common? Why do you think I got that question? I mean, I never really did figure that out, but...
Emphasis on action.
Yeah.
It's the emphasis on action. Fascists, you know, we think of them as exalting the state. And they do, you know, especially in the beginning. But ultimately, at least my take on fascism, especially, you know, the fascist movements that use Robert Pattinson's formulation, the ones that accelerate rather than decline into kind of, you know, sort of dull statism like happened in Spain. But the fascist movements that really accelerate forward, ultimately, they want to use the state as basically almost like, you can almost say like a booster rocket to get to the point where the race or the nation rules without the bureaucratic and legalistic interference of a state, right? That's ultimately what Hitler was going for, some sort of, you know, inconceivable, you know, race empire. The state was just the way to make that happen, and ultimately, of course, it didn't happen. So anarchists obviously don't want to do that, but they, you know, they disdain the state, they exalt action. You know, that's often, you know, the sort of one of my, you know, I don't want to criticize the Antifa too much for this because, you know, they're kind of a ragtag bunch that also have to worry about security culture, right? They can't organize that much because they'll get infiltrated by the police to the more than they presumably already are. And they'll, if they get caught, you know, drilling, making sure that they are organized enough that you don't wind up with them doing stupid shit. At least some of the time, then they would get busted up, you know, or at least they'd be much more vulnerable. But yeah, so that's part of why you have this exaltation to action along, I think, with the ideology. I think that, you know, if you're a kid, right, if you're a kid, you know, so am I correct in assuming that in the Pacific Northwest in the 90s, that a lot of those people who would be going in between green anarchism and fascism, probably a lot of them would be, you know, sort of alienated white kids from kind of your dead end kind of Twin Peak style logging towns.
I don't know about the logging towns. I mean, I lived in Portland, so the people I knew weren't necessarily from there. I would say they might be from Gresham or Beaverton or something, you know, like suburban kids.
Okay. Well, yeah, so it could be both. So it could be suburban kids who are just bored. It could be exurb or like post-industrial malaise type stuff.
These were kids who were like go to Portland Community College, you know.
Okay, yeah. So if you're trying to appeal to them, you know, action and the promise of being part of something that's kind of outlaw, that's kind of outside, that, you know, that you have this solidarity, you against the world. And, you know, you don't necessarily have that much of a vision of a better future. You have some kind of faraway thing like fascism and its eventual racial utopia or green anarchism, where, I don't know, you know, billions of people die and then you get to just walk around the woods for a while. But it's not anything you really have to plan towards. You know, you could see why that would appeal to people more than, you know, mainstream ideologies or just, you know, normal, if you could really call that normal socialism. Right, with its, which seems kind of bureaucratic and kind of tired, involving a lot of tiresome organizing people who you probably wouldn't want to hang out with normally.
Right. Yeah, I mean, this I think is the thing you're getting to it here. It's this anti-modernity stance that the fascists and the anarchists have in common, especially green anarchists.
At least green anarchists. Yeah.
They one of the things that capitalism is good at is bringing people together who don't share a lot in common other than the collective purpose of their job, right?
They can
organize people in ways that are not cultural or tribal. And actually, that's one of the things I like about living in a capitalist world. There's freedom in that. You know, I'm against the exploitation of workers, and I want to see a better version of modernity, but you know, that is one of the good things about modernity. But if you take the stance that that is a bad thing about modernity, and I think green anarchists and fascists both do, then you might have – that's the common ground.
Yeah, I know that in the Northeast, at least in New York, and I think to a certain extent New England, there's been sort of entryism, you know, efforts on the part of sort of Volkish-type fascists, or as they call themselves, national anarchists, which really should be a contradiction in terms, but to kind of infiltrate anarchist, sort of main, if you want to call that mainstream anarchist circles, right? So they try and set up at book fairs and this and that. Of course, it leads to, as you can imagine, extremely fractious debates. And then usually some, you know, Antifa make it clear that they will, you know, physically fight them to stop them from doing it. And then they usually get the boot. So you do get a certain amount of, and, you know, it's an interesting space, sort of culturally, psychologically speaking, that it'd be interesting if people did more work sort of looking at that. The only book I've ever read that even touches on this stuff was, you remember Paladin Press?
Maybe.
They used to put out these kind of sketchy, like, notionally they were, like, informative, like, sociological books about crime, but a lot of them were clearly about, like, the gory details of whatever, you know, like, or they were stuff about how to, you know, notionally were for law enforcement, but they were stuff about how to do, you know, crimes. It was the kind of thing that if you ever mailed away for one of their books, you would get put on a list somewhere. But at a used bookstore, I found an old Paladin Press, a book about skinheads in actually Portland in the 80s. It was written by a cop, or possibly an ex-cop who had worked the kind of skinhead gangs. And he said that it was actually quite common. So you had your two kinds. You had your Nazi racist kind and your anarchist anti-racist kind. And he said it was extremely common for people to switch. You know, some kid is part of a, you know, racist skinhead gang. They either break up or they get their asses beat by somebody. And, you know, so they switch. They just go over to the nearest gang over, which could be an anarchist, anti-racist gang, as long as they haven't got the wrong tattoos. You know, it doesn't really make, you know, the ideology doesn't make that much of a difference.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. And it would go the other way as well.
You could easily do the other way. I don't think that characterizes the Antifas I know are ideological. Whatever else you want to say about them, they might be action-oriented. They might have various problems with their praxis, but they definitely are, you know, quite ideological from everything I've seen in terms of being leftist anarchist and being anti-racist.
I've known in the last year or so about five different anarchists and Marxists or far leftists who've gone pro-Trump and sometimes even full, like, alt-right racial realists. Yeah, and they are not, it's not like these people were not ideological, right? But their ideology was, I guess, secondary to their feeling that they didn't, the society they were in was unsatisfying. You know, that's a muted way to say it. But so that shows that the culture war aspect of this is not insignificant, because, you know, that the alt-right is snatching up people who were pretty well identified with far left organizations or publications or at least ideology and online culture. If they're able to move, you know, let's say some significant fraction over to their side, that shows that something's happening culturally, and that it was happening before Trump, I think.
Yeah, you know, you got a certain amount of that in the 30s as well, actually. You got a certain amount of communists actually switching over, probably arguably most famously Simon Sabiani, who was the mayor of Marseille all throughout the occupation period, and I believe before as well, who started out as a communist, kind of a syndicalist with the dock workers, I believe. I'd have to look it up. But then, you know, the politics of Popular Front era France, I guess, disgusted him sufficiently that he went over to the right. You got a fair, and, you know, Mussolini himself, right? Started out as this sort of socialist with, you know, again, the syndicalist leanings, and then he winds up founding the original fascist party. As far as I in terms of what to do about that, I think the main thing to do would be to organize further, and, you know, not to be too tendentious about this, but to organize with people who aren't internet people, if that makes any sense, right? Like the kind of people who aren't, who have real day-to-day concerns in their lives, with their jobs, with their communities, rather than trying to kind of scoop up the people who are spouting. And trust me, I've spouted off on many a forum in my day. I'm not a good example. They don't need that many more of me. We need a lot more of, you know, ordinary people. And I think there's been a certain amount of success with that, you know, with many, and we're going to need a lot more of that success. We're going to need to do a lot more of that work. And hopefully we can organize enough of those people that the people who, the sort of alienated intellectual types who go over, will be, you know, outnumbered.
I feel like you're talking directly to me with that advice. And it's like, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to do that. I am so...
Well, you're not going to be able to do what?
To leave the internet. I cannot.
No. Don't leave the internet. The internet's wonderful. Stay on the internet. The internet's great. You don't have, like I said, you don't have to turn into Cesar Chavez overnight or at all. Just, you know, a little bit